The sun is setting on another day in Franschhoek. It's time to kick back with a glass of Chenin Blanc and a charcuterie board. I'm Sarah Rovang.
And I'm John Golden. You're listening to Sundowners, conversations about architecture, place, and global travel. Also featured in this episode will be the inescapable background sounds of Cape Town traffic. Apologies, listeners. Now, theme music! Hi, Sarah.
Hi, John. It's been kind of a strange week, huh?
Yeah, we've been kind of lying low in the Cape Winelands, and you've been recovering from a cold. And for really only the second time on the trip, we've had to deal with bad weather.
Yeah, that's right. It might be the dry season up in Johannesburg and in Kruger, but it's the wet season here in the Western Cape.
And it has not been warm either. As we discovered in Kimberley, these more inland areas get pretty chilly overnight.
I've definitely missed central heating. We made do with a little space heater and an electric blanket at our last Airbnb, but there were plenty of mornings where we wore our big coats around the apartment.
Yeah, and it's been a very different landscape than what we've seen previously in South Africa.
Yeah, did it sort of surprise you as we drove west along the Cape?
Definitely. The countryside became more and more agricultural, and also just more green. Pretty soon, you know, rolling hills turned into actual mountains as we made our way into the valleys of the winelands.
Yeah, it felt really rugged, but also really verdant and picturesque.
So, Sarah, what made you want to come to this part of South Africa? It certainly didn't feel industrial in the same way that Joburg or Pilgrim's Rest or Kimberley did.
Right, yeah. So I had sort of two primary motivating questions behind adding this particular stop to our itinerary. The first was really the question of how the winemaking industry has changed in this area over time. You know, has machinery really replaced manual labor, or are there some ways in which winemaking is kind of the same now as it has ever been? And also, I guess along with that, of course, is how the architecture of the wineries has altered to accommodate those changes. And then the sort of second big question I was looking at is more generally about heritage preservation in South Africa. As I talked about in my most recent blog post, in 2015, South Africa's government made some really big changes to the list of places it's trying to nominate for UNESCO World Heritage status. And for reasons that are still unknown, even to people who work in the heritage industry and know about these things, the government removed several major industrial heritage sites, including places we've seen, like Pilgrim's Rest and Kimberley. The only site that is still on the tentative list that can be considered even kind of vaguely industrial is actually a collection of these early farms in the Cape Winelands. So I wanted to see for myself these buildings that, at least in the eyes of the government nominating committee, deserve to stay on the list while these others were kicked off.
Yeah, and if I kind of understand it correctly, it's the kind of buildings that we saw this past week in the Cape that historically have gotten, you know, the bulk of the heritage funding and attention in South Africa. I mean, there's clearly a lot more money here.
Yeah, exactly that. During apartheid, most attempts at preservation and historic interpretation really focused on the Dutch colonial past of the country. Since the apartheid government started as an Afrikaner ethnic party, playing up historic Dutch contributions to South Africa was a way of legitimizing their very dubious claim to power.
Yeah, and this was definitely, like, clearly a very iconic type of architecture.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I mean, even to my untrained eye, you know, there was just some really clear and kind of repetitive features of the buildings. You know, there are these massive whitewashed walls, really impressive thatched roofs, and very, like, robust gables, you know, and everything was very symmetrical. You know, the floor plans we saw were, like, super consistent across basically all the places.
Yeah, the Dutch typically built in this sort of T-shaped plan that we saw over and over, to which an additional building could be added at the back to form an H-shaped plan.
Yeah, so, I mean, I feel like you could just immediately tell, you know, what were the historic Cape Dutch buildings.
Yeah, it's also a basic form that persists really strongly over time. you know, a lot of the very obvious visible architectural changes are concentrated in that central gable. And you can sort of chart the rise and fall of different architectural trends just by looking at that gable.
Yeah, I can definitely see why that image would be so powerful in creating, you know, this idea of national heritage.
Yeah, and also why so many wineries have chosen to maintain that image in newer buildings. We saw very few examples of new construction that didn't directly borrow or iterate on traditional Cape Dutch vernacular in some way. And if there was new construction designed to look modern at a winery, it was typically in the form of a glass box, basically meant to be as transparent as possible.
Yeah, and we saw that at the Babylon Storin Winery yesterday, where the tasting area is just this big glass box directly attached to a cellar built in like this very traditional fashion.
Yeah, it was certainly fascinating to see how and to what extent the wineries made it obvious which were the original buildings and which were new construction. Some of the ones that had these very old manor houses that were done up with period furniture, but often all of the old and new just kind of seemed jumbled together. And you could really only tell for sure sometimes if the construction date was embossed on the central gable, which happens pretty frequently because it's kind of part of the architectural style.
Yeah, I mean, I guess more generally, it also just felt like the wineries we visited really had different approaches to dealing with history in sort of a broad sense.
Yes, so the older wineries we saw were actually mostly established at the end of the 1600s, by the Dutch East India Company and Huguenot refugees who were escaping religious persecution in France.
Yeah, and as was referenced numerous times, you know, this is when the Dutch were importing slaves from India, Indonesia, and Mozambique, to name just a few places.
So many of these beautiful old manor houses we saw were built by slaves from all these different places. And then when the British showed up and took control of the Cape at the beginning of the 19th century, they outlawed the slave trade, and then eventually slavery in practice as well. Slavery in South Africa officially ended here in 1834, but the slaves were forced to stay on as quote-unquote apprentices until 1838.
Yeah, but you know, obviously the end of slavery didn't mean that things were suddenly great for former slaves. You know, most of them lacked any economic opportunity and basically just went back to the same agricultural work under the same conditions.
Yeah, and the farms of the winelands were obviously still operational during apartheid. One thing I learned yesterday was that many farm owners did not enforce the Group Areas Act that mandated all the races live separately, because it just wasn't economically sensible for them to do so. But non-white agricultural workers then, during apartheid, lived under the constant threat of eviction. If the owner was displeased for any reason, he could just suddenly decide to enforce that group areas law and throw you and your family off the farm.
Yeah, so clearly just because slavery ended, it did not mean the end to coercive or exploitative labor practices, particularly during apartheid.
Yeah, anyway, so basically all of the old vineyards and farms in this area have the same baggage of slavery. But the way they handle that is really different. Kind of in the manner, I think, of many of the various former plantations that you can visit today in the American South.
Yeah, so many just took the basic approach of focusing on the life of the white family living in the manor house.
Or, if slavery was mentioned, it was just kind of glossed over. At Babylon Storin, there was a sequence of really aesthetically appealing dioramas made out of cut paper in a style that felt kind of like a Victorian collage. And they told the story of the biosphere and the people of the area and how that changed over time in response to the arrival of European settlers. But the whole thing was just so beautiful to look at that the gravity of the situation actually didn't really come through. The artistry overshadowed the historical content.
Yeah, they were definitely vibey, but the horrors of slavery and apartheid kind of got lost.
Yeah, it was really different from the first winery we visited on Saturday, Solms Delta. I knew from reading online that they had a museum on the premises, but if I hadn't known what to look for, I would have never known it was there.
Yeah, it was not well advertised at all. I didn't even see a single sign for it.
Yeah, but once we did find it, wow, this winery did a really convincing job of confronting its own historical complicity in enforcing racial inequality. It was clear that they had hired some serious researchers to put this museum together. There was all kinds of archival evidence even to back up the claims being made.
Yeah, there was like this one section that showed how racist policies were embedded in the winery's property deeds over time.
Yeah, and also it covered the whole apartheid era too, which is something we didn't really see at any other winery or even historic museum in this region. Everything else really just focused on slavery exclusively, but the museum at Solms Delta had several panels about the unique experience of rural and agricultural workers during apartheid.
Yeah, and it seems like those workers faced a very different set of challenges than people of color in urban areas.
Yeah, certainly. And I also really liked how much oral history they had done with their own workers. It seemed like a pretty genuine effort to give voice to people who worked on this vineyard during and after apartheid.
Yeah, and they've now even set up a trust where a portion of their profit goes into the community with the goal of helping, the next generation pursue whatever careers they want, not just those sort of enforced on them by their condition. Yeah, it really seemed like this particular winery felt strongly about making reparations. And it's really kind of a wonder to me that more wineries in the area don't have similar initiatives. Or, for that matter, basically any old apartheid-era company should be doing something like this.
Yeah, and in addition to doing good for the community from a capitalistic standpoint, it also just seems like really good PR. We didn't taste the wine at Solms Delta, but I definitely got a positive feeling about the brand.
Yeah, it really stood out as the most frank attempt to face up to the recent past. Many of the other interactions we've had have felt like either avoidance of the past or even in some cases nostalgia for it.
Right, and that was certainly the attitude of the person we interacted with the most during our time here, our Airbnb host. This was an older gentleman of some stature, a bigwig in the community, as well as a businessman and a part-time winemaker. Our interactions with him really gave us a lot to think about in terms of how to be a good guest when your host has views antithetical to your own, and how far moral relativism can stretch when you're out of your own cultural context.
So, on the plus side, he was very excited to hear that we were here to learn about the history and the architecture of Franschhoek.
He definitely went well out of his way to show us around and tell us things.
Which was, moderately helpful. He comes from a very old and prominent family who settled in the Franschhoek area back in the 1600s.
And he's done a lot of civic things in Franschhoek, serving on various boards, being a church elder.
Yeah, we mentioned that we had gone on a little hiking trail above town, and he's kind of said, "Oh, yes, I was on the board for that, got it built and all."
Yeah, so he also knows the editor of the newspaper and tried to get me a meeting with him to learn more about the town.
Yeah, so, this was all very nice of him.
But still, all of this attention would have been a lot easier to handle if not for the, racism.
Oh, the racism. Yeah, I mean, in our first chat with him, he casually dropped in the good old days of apartheid.
I honestly wasn't sure if he was joking or not at first. It caught me so off guard, but quickly it became clear that he was not joking.
No, although of course he went to great pains to emphasize that he was not being what was his word? Racialistic?
Yeah, that's right. Racialistic. Kind of a softer version of racist, it seems.
Yeah, but obviously from his perspective, apartheid really was the good old days. I mean, his dad was actually a sufficiently high-ranking member of the National Party to now have a Wikipedia article about him. Clearly was super motivated by an attraction towards tradition and history. Again, very much in the heritage not hate mindset that we've encountered so frequently here. But he was an equal opportunity dismisser. He was less than thrilled with all of the new money coming into Franschhoek, since so much of the new development did not respect the traditional ways. So I do think for him it was just the tradition, of which apartheid was a big part, that he wanted to go back to.
It was pretty tough dealing with that, though. It was kind of overwhelming, even if he was always really polite to us.
Yeah, and obviously we wanted to be polite to him as well, since he was our host and all. So we ended up mainly just keeping quiet when he would bring up race and try to ask questions about, shall we say, non-racialistic things.
Yeah, I guess for me it was easiest to approach the situation as a historian and basically just let him be himself and hear what he had to say.
Yeah, and I guess in this scenario, I learned it's a lot less taxing to be, wigged out by racist architecture than racist people. So anyway, yeah, our Airbnb put us already in kind of an, let's say, off-put mindset.
And I don't think that the general vibe of Franschhoek did anything to help. It was so bougie.
Yeah, this is really sort of the upmarket, Napa Valley of South Africa. It's the kind of town where you search online for cheap eats and get no results.
And there was a market downtown called Bijou Square, which I think sort of sums up things for me.
And one of the major attractions in the town is a tram, which lets you do a hop-on, hop-off tour of a bunch of different wineries. And we'd heard good things about it online, and it seemed like a reasonable way to get around for the day.
But we quickly learned that we are not wine tour people.
Our particular tram ride was dominated by a rather large group. I think they had like 18 people. And they were probably our age, even though they acted like they were in high school still. And they were also clearly a few rungs up above us, economically speaking.
Well, at least they had a great and clearly very boozy time.
I think it was really interesting that almost all of the people on the tram were South African. And at least during the low season, this seems like it's still predominantly local tourism.
The whole setup of the wine tram is really predicated on the notion, too, that there is some benefit to be had from visiting five or six different wineries in a given day.
Which would mean that the wineries and their wines are appreciably different enough to make that experience worthwhile.
Which is really not what we found. I mean, we were kind of using this as a way to get between the three most historic wineries that I wanted to see. And so, for our purposes, it particularly didn't make sense. I mean, for other folks, though, ostensibly it's a good way not to have to worry about drinking and driving, but at what cost? It seemed like if that was your concern, you could save a lot of hassle by just getting an Uber between vineyards. And perhaps the oddest thing about the tram was, why is there a tram at all? This was like an actual sort of recycled streetcar that maybe they'd gotten out of Cape Town or somewhere on a railway that ran up and down between wineries. And it just definitely didn't make any sense logistically.
Yeah, it was so slow. At the end of the day, we realized we had spent more time on the tram than visiting vineyards.
And it also didn't make sense historically. It's not like there was even a tram in Franschhoek back in the olden days. Some rich investor basically got permission to run this tram on an old railway line. But I guess it evokes some kind of nostalgia or romanticism for the past.
But it would have been a lot more efficient to just have a bus. For me, it evoked the sort of existential dread on the tram. I feel like Bob Dylan could have just as easily sung "Stuck Inside of Franschhoek with the Wine Tram Blues Again."
I think the strange ahistorical feeling of some of the vineyard's tourism infrastructure, such as the wine tram, and the ritzy vibe of Franschhoek more generally, are both indicators of the same underlying condition. As our Airbnb host shared, this is actually an area that has seen a very rapid influx of new money in the last 2 decades. The people who run these vineyards are, in many cases, billionaires.
Yeah, Richard Branson owns a hotel down the road from where we stayed, and the Rupert family, who I guess own like British American Tobacco and are worth $16 billion, own many of the vineyards and farms in Franschhoek. And this other one that we went to was owned by a diamond magnate, and that one really actually felt like a Bond villain place. It was creepy.
So these are folks who are not relying on wine production to make a living. These are really lifestyle or pleasure vineyards. This has become a playground for the ultra rich. And we certainly weren't overwhelmed by the quality of wine in the region either. Reportedly, better wine is grown about an hour north, where there's also substantially less tourism.
Yeah, so really, then the main industry in the area is tourism, which means that seemingly silly or inefficient things like the wine tram are somehow viable. This area is a really easy drive from Cape Town, and given the admittedly impressive natural beauty of the area, it's not surprising that it's a desirable weekend getaway.
Yeah, I guess for a supposedly agricultural area, it's really more of a capital consuming region than it is a capital producing region.
Yeah, it's been interesting how some of the places we've found kind of most uncomfortable here in South Africa have also been the most affluent.
So, All in all, I would say this little Winelands getaway wasn't quite what we expected.
Yeah, we were so excited to come here. I felt like it would just be a good place to relax and write.
But in the end, it just felt really disconnected from reality. This kind of uncomfortable combination of wealth and nostalgia.
So here's hoping Cape Town will be better.
Oh, I'm sure it will be. That's all for this week, folks. As always, our theme music is by Mark Barrett.
And next week, we'll feature special guest star and friend of the pod, Devin Wohl, who will be joining us in Cape Town all the way from Washington, D.C.
Until then, happy trails, listeners!